Hi guys. Today we're taking a bit of a breather from the heaviness and controversy, and we are having a fun episode. I'm bringing Jessa back. Before we dive in and talk about all of the following, sex trials, public biases, attorney scrutiny, as well as running the gamut from Michael Peterson to Casey Anthony to OJ, I want to issue a thank you to you. Last week's jury break, I noted some criticism I've been receiving, and it comes up for a minute today too, but something I don't want to get lost is how much sweetness and support I've also been receiving, how much affirmation that has meant the world to me. This is a tough season, and you are so fucking cool that you're listening to it in your free time, and caring, and saying what you want to say, and being uncensored and truthful and having this uncomfortable dialogue. I cannot overstate how grateful I am to all of you. I'm thin-skinned and take small criticisms harder than the overwhelming and beautiful outpouring of support that you show me. And that's on me, and I'm going to work on that. And in the meantime, I just want to say, I know I have the smartest audience in podcasting. Jesus, you show such obvious desire to witness social change. You listen when it's hard and speak when it's hard. And I see that, and I want to learn from it. So now, let's have some fun. So we're here with Jessa Nicholson Getz, and the first thing I want to say to you, Jessa, is that I've missed you.
I know, I miss you too. I'm so happy to be back.
So am I. Honestly, I feel like you are a presence that has been missed, and not just by me, I'm sure, but by the whole audience. And for anyone who strangely hasn't listened to Getting Off, I'm sure they're exceptionally grateful that you're making a reappearance today. For those who have heard Getting Off, I think this talk will be pretty fun for you, because this is just going to be a sort of catch up between the two of us, and there are some things that I want to check in with Jessa about. For example, I'd like to firstly congratulate you on Getting Off's huge success.
Thank you. It's been going well. We've been having a lot of fun with it.
Oh my God, it's really fun to listen to. I'm no spoilers. I'm halfway through the Michael Peterson, the one that just released.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. And first of all, it's so endearing in the beginning when you say when you talk about audio and you talk about I don't have any problem with your audio, by the way.
You know, it's so funny. It's like there's always something, I guess.
Yeah.
Because our whole concept of the way that we do our show is really that we're just lawyers talking shit. You know, the thing that we thought we had to add to the podcasting world is that we can actually offer something that resembles legal expertise on some of the true crime stuff. Mm-hmm. Because a lot of times people have questions like, well, why didn't we hear about the fact that, you know, he was accused of killing his first wife? Why didn't anyone get to introduce the blood alcohol level of the victim? Why, you know, there are all sorts of questions like that, and we can answer those questions. What I have no ability to answer is how one, like, dubs music into the background for dramatic effect.
Oh.
I can't do that. And I don't have the patience or inclination to continue to have to embarrass myself greatly by watching this lovely 13-year-old girl who does YouTube tutorials about audio quality. And like, I've already had to watch 6 of them and email her.
Okay, you have a personal relationship with this girl now.
With this 13-year-old girl, yes, on YouTube, because that is apparently where my skill set is. Not to knock her very tech-savvy ways.
Oh, I'm sure she's super savvy. I'm sure she's way savvier than I am. I'm nowhere close to YouTube tutorial level of mastery.
No. And, you know, so like not to knock her, but it's very humbling to realize that you have a graduate degree and don't know how to make buttons light up.
There's a lot to learn. There's a lot there.
Audio issues aside, so yeah, if people haven't listened to it yet, here's the deal with us. We typically split a bottle of wine and talk about a case, and you can hear us drinking the wine, and you can hear one of my two dogs barking in the background often, because Alibi comes everywhere with me. And
oh my God,
and then we talk about crime and the law, and we, you know, try and provide perspective perspective that's a little bit different than sort of the true crime profile, pro-prosecution bent that is out there with a lot of people that do more legally sort of minded true crime stuff.
That's true. Real Crime Profile is are you talking about the podcast with Jen Clemente and
Yeah.
It is pretty prosecution leaning now that I'm thinking about it. I'm recalling an episode, and this is an old episode because I haven't listened in a while, unfortunately, but Jim Clemente was talking about his problem with the difference between prosecution and defense, and he said that the prosecution is held to a higher standard and that they can only present material at trial, or they can only present a narrative that they believe is true, they can prove is true, and the defense, and forgive me if I'm butchering this, this paraphrasing anyone, but the defense can introduce a completely false narrative, and they're allowed to do that, and so he felt like prosecution is held to that higher standard of truth, I guess.
So I have a lot of responses to that. First off, Jim, who I actually have a lot of respect for generally, but he is pretty pro-prosecution. And I will say this, to me, as a defense attorney, when I hear statements like that, my initial reaction is, God, that is just so typical of the arrogance of prosecutors. It is so arrogant of people in power to think that they have a monopoly on truth. Why is his truth more real than the truth that my client experiences? Well, the answer is what the jury determines. That's where the truth is. And defense attorneys' jobs, a lot of time, is to reject what the people with power, the prosecutors and the judiciary, say is the truth, and to force everyone to look at alternate versions of what truth might be. And that's not like wordplay for me. It's something that really I view as a responsibility in my profession to challenge those notions of absolute truth, and that we should confine what our determinations are to what happens on the record and what happens in the courtroom and what is proven. Second of all, there's a whole separate special section of every state's ethical rules and the ABA standard that talks about the special responsibilities of prosecutors. And they are held to a higher standard, but that's because, again, they are given a lot more power than the rest of us. And so there needs to be something in place to check that power, because without that, we just have an unfettered ability to take people off the street and lock them up. And so, yes, you know, if we're gonna get Star Wars about it, then with great power comes great responsibility. Or is that Spider-Man? Some fucking movie.
It's Spider-Man, but yes.
I don't know.
I wouldn't have realized if you hadn't questioned it afterwards.
yeah, that's true, Jim. But that's because that's what you signed up for. When you sign up to be a prosecutor, you signed up to uphold that sort of higher standard in terms of being held to additional ethical constraints. And there's a reason for that. It's not as though people are just picking on you. And then the third thing I would say, God, I have a lot of responses. The third thing I would say is, it is obvious to me that somebody who made that comment has never attempted to tell a false narrative to a jury. Because do you know who figures that out faster than anybody else? It's the 12 people in the box. If you get up and you lie to them, if you aren't being truthful, you're done. You're done and your client's done. And there's nothing you can say to change that.
Well, that's the way it's supposed to work.
What's that?
Well, that's the way it's supposed to work. I mean, I'm thinking of tying it back to Michael Peterson, like the episode of yours I'm listening to right now, you talk about how the prosecution introduces the blowpoke as their narrative and as the weapon, and they stick to it. And they're like, this is what was used. And you actually admired that choice because it was like a strong choice, because you felt that jurors really like to have a narrative. But when that blowpoke was realized mid-trial, and I guess pause this episode or skip ahead if you aren't through with the getting off episode, or if you haven't seen The Staircase, spoiler alert. But you know, when the trial realizes that the blowpoke wasn't the weapon, then the jurors didn't seem to hold that against the prosecution, at least not enough to acquit Michael Peterson.
Yeah, and obviously there were some other shenanigans at play there, and fortunately that wrong was, in my view, righted, though of course it took 8 years. But, you know, that's true. I would have held it against them. I think that there's probably more leeway for the prosecution to get small facts wrong. And I think that probably a murder weapon is, in my view, bigger than a small fact.
Yeah.
But, you know, but I think some people probably, if they were convinced of the motive and the opportunity, they could overlook that. But I can tell you one of the things that I believe very strongly and that I work very hard to do in every case I have is to identify what about that case I believe is true. What do I truly as a human being, not just as a lawyer, what in it can I ID as truth? And I try and write my whole case narrative around the things that I think are true, because that to me is the most credible way to talk to people.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you a question.
Yeah.
So I've heard this story from someone I know who was on a jury, and the trial was about, it was a vandalism charge, and a man was accused of having broken a woman's window. I guess he came to the house, they were emotionally, you know, charged. She closed the door, she wouldn't let him in, and he was mad, and he started to walk away, and then he turned around and allegedly broke her window with a rock. Now, the prosecution presented a narrative in which this one enormous rock that was, like, I guess kind of bordering on Boulder or something, it was a very large rock, was the rock that he used to break the window. And it just didn't seem plausible to the jury. When they got back to the jury room, everyone was talking and agreed that this guy definitely broke her window. Like, they didn't see how it was anybody else. They definitely believed it was him, but they didn't believe that that was the rock that was used. And the prosecution was definitive about that being part of the narrative. And so because he was charged with breaking the window with that rock, they acquitted this man. So I'm asking you, do you think that was right or wrong? Because I've wrestled with that internally. I feel like if I was on the jury, I probably would have still wanted to convict him.
Well, and I'm obviously working off of the Wisconsin statute for criminal damage to property, mm-hmm. but there's nothing in our statutes that would require proof of what the method of destruction was. For us, the question is, did someone intentionally damage the property, yes or no? Mm-hmm. And was that damage done without the property owner's consent? As long as those things are true, that there was an intent, there was damage, and it was without consent, then the guy is guilty. At least if that trial were happening here. Now, if they have some weird statute where you have to be able to identify, like, the mode of damage, maybe that's a little closer question. I like the jury's spirit in wanting to make the prosecution, you know, be accountable for proving every element. I just don't know that I think that the choice of rock is actually an element of that crime.
Right. I mean,
so
yeah, even if I thought the prosecution was wrong about a part of their narrative, if I had no doubts about whether someone was guilty, I think I'd convict him anyway. But I wasn't in the room.
I'm the subject of cases with strong feelings about guilt or innocence. Did you get a chance to listen to our Casey Anthony?
Oh, yes. I listened to every minute.
It was so hard. We had such a difficult time doing it.
Difficult? Why? Talk to me.
Well, I mean, all right. So for me, one thing that I really struggled with was apparently where I am in my life right this minute. I have a lot of bias towards somebody who I perceive to be a bad mother.
Right.
And I don't know where that even came from in me. I mean, not that most people are like, yay, bad mother. but I was surprised at, like, the amount of vitriol that I had for these facts about, like, well, she didn't call the police for a month, you know? Because I certainly am able to understand why some clients I have, even if they were innocent of the thing they're being accused of, might run from police. You know, I can provide a very logical narrative that is consistent with innocence for running from the police, but why couldn't I provide that narrative for somebody who failed to call them for a month? And I think I was focused on the dead child. And that made me feel guilty because I'm always preaching that people need to be able to set aside their own bias to try and determine, you know, what's fair and what's right and follow the law. And I really struggled with doing that.
Oh my God.
It was tough for me. And my defense attorney friends who listened to the podcast, which is, for those of you that haven't heard those episodes, Nick, my partner, came down and he would acquit. And I came down that I would convict. At least I would convict on the accidental death. And I got a lot of messages from my friends that are like, Jessa, what the hell?
Oh, really?
How can you say that? You don't know what the cause of death was.
Oh, no, I totally am in your camp on that. And no offense to anyone who doesn't. Like, I respect the other viewpoint, but at the same time, oh, I just feel so like there's no one in this world I hate as much as Casey Anthony. There's no one that I wish was convicted more than Casey Anthony. I'm very emotional about it. And if I read Jeff Ashton's book, who was one of her prosecutors, called Imperfect Justice, and that actually sheds a lot of light on that month that she spent in which she didn't call the police. And the more you find out about her or this case or her relationships at all, the more you want her to be convicted. She spent so much time with this guy named Tony Lazzaro, who she was apparently infatuated with. And like for that entire month, all she was doing was like hanging out at his house, playing house, or his apartment with all of his roommates, playing house, making them food, like going out with him to the clubs at night, stealing money from her parents. Just, I mean, there was zero indication of any concern. Plus, she spent the entire time consistently lying to each and every person in her life about where Kaylee was. And the more like of a thorough picture you get about the depth and conviction of those lies, the more you just really hate this woman. The one part of the Casey Anthony coverage that you did that I was like kind of screaming at my radio at was when you guys were talking about Dr. G's testimony. And I think maybe I was emotional because I felt like you were right, but it was something that I didn't want to face. First of all, Dr. G had her own show, and I used to watch that too before the Casey Anthony trial. It was just this, it was called Dr. G Medical Examiner, and she was a Florida, Orlando medical examiner.
Oh, that's funny.
Yeah. And I know it's so weird. It was this like crazy amount of celebrity and coincidence all wrapped up in that trial. But Dr. G, when she was on the stand, she talked about how she had said that the manner of death was homicide. And you guys were like, well, you can't really say that. It was just, you know, like she was so decomposed by the time they found the body, and there was no way to tell if she died accidentally or, you know, by murder. So it really wasn't reasonable for her to come down on that. But the part of her testimony that I found compelling, contrarily to your viewpoint, was that she said that the mandible was still affixed to the skull with the duct tape, and that there's no way that that duct tape could have, and this, if I'm recalling correctly, there's no way that duct tape could have like just happenstance, like landed around the head of that child. And so she surmised, you know, like after decomposition had begun, like it must have been placed prior to death or around the time of death. And she's, you know, surmised that there was no reasonable explanation for duct tape to appear on the face of child. And so homicide was indicated.
And I actually buy that. I think Nick won the day for that.
Yeah.
I think he was more persuasive than I was. Because that's why I was comfortable convicting on at least an accidental level, is I thought the duct tape placement was relevant.
Yeah, I did too.
That in the episode, but I feel it.
Yeah. And that's why I could never buy a pool related theory, is because of the duct tape. Because if she died in a pool and they threw her in bags and threw her body in the woods, there is no reason for that duct tape to have been there.
Right.
So, sorry. Dr. G's soapbox stepping off. But I did love that coverage. And guys, if you haven't listened to Getting Off yet, or if you don't know which episode to start on and you have any like slight or minor interest in Casey Anthony, please listen to these episodes. They're really, really good. You get like a really thorough like legal breakdown of what went on there. And it was really refreshing just hearing something from another side, because everything that I tend to consume about Casey Anthony is so pro-guilt. And I do that, I guess, purposely, but also because there's not really a lot else out there.
Right. Well, she's not a popular person to want to defend.
Right. It doesn't help me that Jose Baez, her defense attorney, is, I mean, not almost as unlikable as she is. I'm not going to say that, but he gets under my skin so bad. That fucking guy.
I got to tell you, when we did Aaron Hernandez, mm-hmm. when I found out he was the lawyer on the second trial, I was like, oh God, here we go. But his performance was actually much, much better in Hernandez, in my view. Where I was like, all right, this was actually some pretty decent lawyering. Like, I kind of get it. Because he drove me nuts in Casey Anthony as well. Right. And I really liked the prosecutors.
Yeah, I remember you saying that.
You know, I found them compelling and likable, and I thought they were doing their job well. I thought that their openings were good. I thought the closings were good. I thought they understood the rules of evidence. They didn't seem to be cheaters to me. You know, I mean, all of the things that check my boxes.
Yeah.
But
they were good. I really liked them too. I thought they were so thorough and had their shit together so, so well. And I actually liked them on a personal level. I remember Jeff Ashton, and this is, I actually shouldn't like this or respect it, but he, if you remember, he laughed during Jose's closing arguments.
Yeah. You know what though? I mean, to me, yeah. Okay. That's probably bad form. But like, we've all been there, okay? Sometimes, like, first of all, it's very stressful to be in a trial, particularly a murder trial. We don't have the death penalty in my state, so I've never had to try a capital case, thankfully, because that sounds horrendous to me. But like, moments of levity are necessary, and sometimes, and I'm thinking of two instances in particular where, one, I could just not get it together because I was laughing so hard at such an inappropriate time.
Right. But human reaction is also real.
Right. And sometimes you're tired. Like, you know, I don't think people realize how little I sleep when I'm in trial prep and when I'm in trial. I mean, I've been in prep for a couple weeks now. And I will tell you, I sleep 3 or 4 hours a night, and that's for weeks. And then in trial, if I get 3 hours of sleep, it's a gift. I wake up every 20 minutes.
Oh, God.
So by the time you're, and then I have this problem where I can't eat until I'm done with the jury for the day.
Oh, because you have no appetite or you get nauseated?
Yeah, I just have no appetite. I eat like an absolute pig during trial prep. Because I'm a stress eater generally. But then once I'm in trial, I can't eat. I can sometimes get like a yogurt down in the morning with my coffee. But I get sick if I have food in my stomach. So usually what that means is by the time I'm trying a serious case, and somewhere my clients are listening to this going, oh my God, why? Why did I hire her? But usually by the time I'm 5 days into a serious trial, I haven't slept more than 4 hours a night in a month, and I probably haven't eaten anything in 9 hours. So I'm sort of delirious.
I totally get that. And when you are like just completely physically and mentally exhausted like that, you're going to react and respond in very unexpected ways and unpredictable ways.
You know, and I know some lawyers that don't have that problem, but I know a lot of lawyers that can't eat during trial.
Oh.
A lot. So that, it's my understanding that that's actually a fairly common problem.
I have no idea how you handle such a high-pressure job.
I drink. I always tell people that. People think I'm kidding. I'm like, no, really, I'm a wino. I don't drink, like, on the job, but I have a glass of wine or two after work.
So do you only and have you only ever defend sensitive crimes, or...
So I occasionally will take other cases. I have a couple of clients who I've known for years that, like, would get a disorderly conduct or some, you know, possession of marijuana while they were in college, since I work in a college town. And then they'll pick up, like, a drunk driving 10 years later, and I'll say, yeah, I'll keep your drunk driving. But generally speaking, the way that we divide things in the office, Nate Otis, one of my business partners, is just a fabulous Fourth Amendment litigator. I don't really typically litigate the Fourth Amendment in sensitive crimes cases. Those issues tend to be Fifth or Sixth Amendment issues. So it just makes more sense in terms of areas of expertise to let him do the drug stuff, because he knows the law better than I do.
Right.
So, you know, at any given time, I might have a few smaller cases from clients I've had for a long time that have just come back and said, can you take care of this? I got the speeding ticket. And I'm like, yeah, no problem. You know, like, that's totally fine. But it's probably been at least the last 5 years that I really haven't taken any serious cases that aren't conflict crimes in some way. So it's been a while.
I was going to ask if you found those to be more stressful than other types of cases, sensitive crimes.
I mean, I think yes and no. So, you know, sensitive crimes cases, there's a lot more crying.
Yeah.
For anyone involved. And those tend to be the cases where you get the most raw human reactions, because they're typically very serious. On the other hand, and this is part of, there are a lot of reasons why I sort of geared my practice towards the sensitive crimes area. But one of the reasons that was very selfish on my part is I have some personal beliefs, some political beliefs about the way that we use the prison system for drug offenders, that made those sentencings very difficult for me.
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't believe in sending people to prison solely for punishment purposes. And I don't believe that nonviolent offenders should go to prison. I mean, those are my, you know, people can disagree with that and that's cool, but those are my beliefs.
Right.
That it was always very hard for me to see somebody who was a nonviolent offender go to prison. Harder than, there were lots of cases, there are lots of sensitive crimes cases where I don't think the prison is necessary, but at least I can look at the objective public safety concern and say, okay, I might not do that, but I understand why somebody did. I understand that I have a bias in this because I've gotten to know this person and their family, and I have my personal beliefs about prisons and what they do or don't do for society. But at least I can track the logic that this person needs to be locked up. I really struggle to even track logically how you get to putting somebody who's done nothing but harm themselves into prison. And so I don't want anyone to hear that and think that I root for my clients to go to prison, or that I somehow think that the way that we treat our inmates is at all anywhere close to acceptable, because it isn't. But I found that I really took those sentences, those would bother me for longer than sentences do when we're dealing with a violent conviction.
That makes sense to me. I can definitely appreciate that standpoint. I have similar views on drug offenses. I think I'm in the most, I'm in California. I think this is the most progressive drug state right now, although don't.
Yeah, I think you guys had some reforms.
Yeah, well, we have marijuana now. It's all legal.
Yep.
That's the only one I really know about, but I wouldn't be surprised.
I'll tell you, if I were reforming things about California, I would make rules about how long your trials can last, because,
oh,
good God.
You know, it's funny, listening to Getting Off, it sounds like you and Nick are constantly appreciating Wisconsin for not having really long jury selections, really long trials, like, you know, laws and structures that don't make sense to you. Like, do you ever, I mean, it sounds like when researching all of these cases, are you sometimes just shocked at the way other states handle legal issues?
Well, I mean, it's generally pretty surprising at the range of the way that things are handled. You know, we're kind of like, wow, that's really different than here. It kind of surprises me that something would be that different. You know, you'd like to think there's maybe a little more continuity from state to state. But one of the things that I've loved about doing the podcast is, because we always pull the jury instructions. I'm sure you've heard us make reference to those. Mm-hmm. And I learn so much from reading other, you know, like, for example, Florida no longer has a circumstantial evidence instruction. And that was fascinating to me because the Wisconsin instruction on circumstantial evidence, I hate. And so now I have this Florida Supreme Court case that I can cite to you not as obviously binding authority, but as persuasive authority for why my judge shouldn't give that instruction.
Oh, wow.
You know, and I found that because I was like, well, why did they abolish this instruction in Florida? I want to know. And then I found this case and I was like, all right, well, I actually really track that. And I'm going to steal some of this language the next time I have to fight about this instruction. California's reasonable doubt instruction is better than Wisconsin's burden of proof instruction. So I have started, I actually made this modification after we researched Brock Turner. I have started asking for a modified jury instruction on burden of proof in my cases that mirrors the California one rather than the Wisconsin one, because I think it's better language for the defendant.
Oh, that's great.
We learn a lot. We try and, you know, we really actually try and apply it to our current work. We think that the podcast makes us better lawyers. Because it makes us work through different problems that we're not used to seeing. And that is helpful.
That is so cool to hear. Has that changed business at all for you, practicing attorneys?
You know, so we've had like a couple people hire us because they're sconnies and they were in need of some assistance. We had, you know, just a couple, and really for small issues, not for anything major, although I'm sure they feel major. I don't mean to diminish that if they're listening to me. But like compared to, you know, some of the stuff that we typically handle, they're pretty, in our view, easy to do.
Right.
But so I've seen that. But other than that, you know, I did have a client find the podcast.
A current client or a former client?
A current client.
Was that a positive thing or a negative thing?
Well, it was more like a, I didn't really ever think that through thing. Like, it was fine. I mean, he was actually really engaged about it. He's like, I want to talk about this. Like, you know.
Oh, cool.
I was sort of like, I never really thought about how people would react to me. You know, because the podcast for me is a lot more about my personal opinions than it is about the positions I take as defense counsel. And so, you know, we did... When the Nassar sentencing was happening, we stopped what we were planning on doing and decided to do that right away. And I had expressed what was a very personal opinion, which is I had said, you know, Larry Nassar, you unimaginable coward. How is it possible that you could do this to all of these young women, but you want to be excused from listening to them talk about it? Which is a personal opinion I stand by.
Right.
But I did have people reach out to me and say, well, that wasn't very pro-defendant. And no, I guess it wasn't.
Well, but that's not the premise of the podcast, right? Like, you're not always assuming the role of, like, you know, defender of the subject.
No, you know, I mean, I think that I'm allowed to, I don't think that I stop being a human being because of what I do for a living. I think I'm allowed to make my own determinations about people's character. I happen to a lot of times take positions that are consistent with my role as a defense advocate because those are positions that I believe in. But I'm not going to sit here and try and sell everybody on the idea that it's cool to molest children.
Right.
Because like, number one, I don't hold that opinion. And number two, if I did, I wouldn't say so where people could hear me.
Yes. And thank you for that. And I'm well aware that you don't hold that opinion. Right. And neither do I for the listening audience.
Oh, yeah. Speaking of that, here now I'm going to put you on that one. Yeah. There's been a lot of controversy about this season. How are you doing with that?
Not great. I've been really stressed, and it's been affecting me.
See, let me just say this. Perhaps it's the last 12 years of my life that influences this. But let me just say, it's very freeing when you just finally give up the ghost and realize that, like, you just believe things that people don't like. Because I am aware that I hold minority viewpoints about many, many things. and I'm allowed to. For me, one of the things that has been hard, and I think was more active in your Facebook group last season than I am this season, because the thing that I keep wanting to say over and over and over again is, I don't know how we're having a conversation about victim blaming at all yet, because there's been no finding of facts here.
Right.
No one's been found to be a victim of anything yet. It's possible that there will be that finding, and then I think we can talk about that. But, to me, the first thing is to establish the facts. We're not even halfway through this case. Nobody knows what the facts are completely yet. We haven't heard this woman's testimony, for example. Your complaining witness has not yet testified. We heard openings. Opening statements aren't evidence. So right now, we don't actually have a complainant with testimony on the record.
Right.
So how are we supposed to assess that person's credibility and determine if they're a victim or not until we hear that?
Yeah, and to that point, I've struggled with just the terminology to use when describing Riley Page, because alleged victim, I worry that if I say alleged victim, that's somehow just like it will rub people the wrong way, because it's discrediting her in some fashion, and that I should refer to her as victim. But I can't refer to her as a victim because that hasn't been established. And so complainant is the one that I've sort of been leaning on more. But just the terminology alone is something that I struggle with in that way.
Well, and, the two that I use the most commonly are accuser or complaining witness.
Accuser is a good one. I should do that.
Because that to me is the legal status of that person at the time the trial starts.
Mm-hmm.
Now, depending on which way a verdict goes, they may change statuses. Stati.
Yeah, that's true. I don't know.
But to me, that word is just legally loaded. And so that's where I bite down on it, is it has a legal meaning to me. Because, and the reason that I say that is really quite simple. There is a statute in Wisconsin that gives victims rights. And that means that this is, a word that isn't just a casually tossed about word. It means that it triggers legal protection. And so because of that, I think we have to be careful where we use it or how quickly we use it.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. All I know is that I'm going to kill someone next season.
So that you don't have a victim?
Yeah. I don't want another victim or alleged victim or complainant or accuser or complaining witness. I just want someone to be dead to talk about them.
Well, Nick and I have talked about this, where we're like, do you feel like we are allowed to make more jokes about murder? Because I feel like we're allowed to make more jokes about murder.
Yeah, we are.
Why is that? Why are we allowed to make more jokes about murder?
It's funny you bring that up, because I was trying to brainstorm interview subjects for jury breaks, and I had a thought about bringing on a comedian to talk about the topic of rape jokes.
Yeah.
And just to see, because there are a lot of rape jokes in comedy, and they're very controversial, and then every once in a while, a comedian will quote-unquote cross the line, and you'll, see kind of backlash. Like, Daniel Tosh comes to mind. I think he had a rape joke scandal. Yeah. But definitely, yeah, I think that we're socially conditioned to be more comfortable with murder than we are with any sex crime.
I think that's true. And maybe there are good reasons for that. I mean,
yeah.
I'm not really staking out a huge claim on that, but I do think it's interesting. It's certainly something that we've observed, that occasionally occasionally we'll talk about things before we start recording, and one of us will make a joke because we are very dark humored, and we're used to making those jokes privately. And the other one will say, yeah, you can't say that on the podcast, though.
Right. No, absolutely you can't. Like, in season one, something that I really wanted to lean into, or I wanted the jury to lean into, was gallows humor and that sort of dark humor. And I wanted that to come across to listeners like, oh, was that inappropriate? Was that inappropriate? They're laughing and they're deciding this woman's fate, and this is really dark. But in season two, I don't know. I think that to an extent, I still want those breaks of seriousness. I still want levity wherever we can find it. But because the subject matter is so, so sensitive, I think that's why I've leaned into things like PUA and stuff like that, things that they can make jokes about a little more comfortably.
Well, I love the guy who told the story about the burrito. He's my favorite. He's the same guy that made the joke about the Jack Daniels. And I was like, whatever, you can sit with me. Like, you can come over here. We'll just mock everybody. We don't need to concern ourselves with things like justice. We'll just make fun of everything.
That is awesome. Yeah, he's a good performer. His name is Kevin Bryan. But they're all good. I'm really, really proud of my jury this season. And I hope that the rest of the season goes smoothly.
No, I hope so too. And I hope people will continue to engage in the dialogue, because to me, the only way that we're going to get better at handling this, and I think whatever side of this you're on collectively as a country, we can say that we're sort of failing at handling sexual assault.
We are failing. And I think part of what I wanted to do was, you know, facilitate a conversation that would bring divided minds somewhat together, and just kind of do my part to somewhat bridge that gap in the social consciousness when it comes to things like sexual assault. And I don't know if I'm succeeding at all or horribly failing, but that was the intention. But you're right. No matter what I do or what anyone claims, we do systematically fail when it comes to sexual assault, sexual harassment, sex crimes in general.
I think we really do. I don't think that we're doing a particularly adept job of any of it, because I think that there's a lot more to say than what everybody is able to say to get us together.
Right. And I understand it more from a criminal justice perspective, because I understand when there are two people in a room and something happens, you just have one person's word against another, and how can that possibly defeat reasonable doubt? You know, like, if that bar is so high, then how is it reasonable that, you know, most genuine victims are able to bring their wrongdoer to justice? And that's why I'm thinking next week I'd like to have a civil attorney on to speak about maybe civil options for going after somebody if you feel like you can't or unable to go after them criminally. Did that make sense?
It does. And I don't have any insight on that other than to know anecdotally that very rarely happens.
Really?
I mean, I can think of maybe two clients of mine over the past decade plus that have been sued.
For
the intentional tort of battery, which is how you do that.
I wonder why. I mean, it seems like if the bar for, you know, reason, doesn't the burden of proof shift? I don't know. I guess I'll wait and explore this later. But I feel like that is one way of, you know, finding closure for victims.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I think that maybe it could be. I think probably some defendants are just judgment proof. And the other thing that I can understand, and again, I'm not sure that I would land here or not if I were in that position, but I can understand why suing somebody for money would feel comparatively small.
Yeah. Well, absolutely.
In the wake of like such a terrible violation.
And you also face the possible stigma of being accused of just going after this person for money.
Right. And I'm not sure that I'd be interested in signing myself up for that criticism, however warranted a civil suit might be.
Mm-hmm.
I guess I'm actually not thinking specifically about sexual assault. I'm thinking about the toll that the civil trial in the O.J. Simpson situation took on the families of the victims.
Oh, right. You're a big O.J. Simpson fanatic, right?
Oh my God, that's how, you know how you are with Casey Anthony? That's how I am with OJ. I've read every book. I have watched every documentary. I have like a whole bookshelf devoted to OJ.
Wow.
I have the transcripts. That's devotion. All of them.
Oh, really?
Like a psycho.
You know, I never even delved that much into it until, you know, there was this resurgence of interest with the People versus OJ Simpson, and then the ESPN documentary, America versus, I don't remember.
Yeah, I think that's what it, on the subject of the People versus OJ Simpson, which was amazingly, like, I loved it. It was great.
Yeah.
It was so over-dramatized, like starting with Bob Shapiro's eyebrows and all the way through. And I loved all of it. I would say that if people liked it and they're not watching the second season, which is the Versace, they should start watching it.
I haven't started that yet.
Okay.
You're talking to me.
Yeah. So I've been watching it with my husband, and he knows a lot more of the facts than I do. Like the first vacation we ever took together, we went down to Miami and he's like, oh yeah, like Versace's house is down the way. I was like, what now? I hadn't even, like, that one was never on my radar. And he tells me that they are straying pretty substantially from the facts, but it's a very entertaining watch. So being ignorant of the facts, I think it's delightful.
All right, then I'm sure I'm going to enjoy the crap out of it.
Yeah.
Like you eloquently pointed out, they definitely take dramatic license, but it's kind of this delicious dramatic license.
Just like, I don't, like, as much as I think Mark Furman was a racist, I really doubt he was actively polishing Nazi memorabilia, getting ready for his taxi testimony.
Oh, that was such a good show.
I know. Like, where it's just like, all right, guys. Yeah. Like, we've got it. Subtlety has flown out the window. But that's what I loved about it. Versace is living up to that, like, highly dramatized version of telling these stories. And as long as you watch them for what they are and don't cite them as absolute fact, I think that they're pretty compelling narratives. So.
Yeah. I started watching the People versus O.J. Simpson before my boyfriend, and he remembered the trial better than I did. And the first thing I asked him about, because it was fun having this sounding board for someone who had a better recollection of the actual trial than I did, and kind of bouncing off like these crazy characters and storylines off of him. And like, what was that like? You know, like I asked him, where were you when the chase happened? The model of the car is escaping me. Ford.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Bronco.
Bronco. Thank you. Where were you when the Bronco chase happened? So I asked him, what's the deal with this guy, Cato? And he's like, oh, right, that guy. Yeah, I just remember he was a really weird guy. And I was like, but what, like, how significant was he? He's like, I don't really remember how he factors into the case. I just remember him being this weird guy that everyone is kind of borderline obsessed with.
So I will say this about Cato. For the 20th anniversary, I think it was in the LA Times, but may have been in the San Francisco paper. But he wrote an op-ed in about, lessons from OJ.
Really?
And it was so thoughtful and so reflective. And I just went, okay, this guy has way more going on than the way he was portrayed.
Oh my God. I want to read that because
I'll try and find it for you. I think I saved it because, like I said, I'm a weird OJ cult fan.
Excellent. Yeah. Let me know if you find it. I remember during when I was watching the show, I went back and started looking up YouTube clips of the parts of the trial that I was most interested in seeing, like the real version. And the Cato testimony, I remember he was really charming.
Yeah, well, I thought what he had to say about, you know, media sensations and his role in the trial and things, I thought it was really thoughtful. I mean, I was very impressed. And it just kind of goes to show you the way that sometimes the media picks a particular narrative about a person, and that sticks regardless of how truthful it might be.
Yeah. Marsha, can you help me out with the name of the prosecutor?
Marsha Clark.
Marsha Clark. Thank you. Marsha Clark got so much shit from the media during the course of that trial, down to like really vicious things about her yep. haircut and fashion choices. Can I ask, have you ever suffered from that kind of physical scrutiny as an attorney?
Well, so, I mean, I don't think anyone in America has ever had a trial as public as OJ's. Right. So I think she probably got it the absolute worst out of anyone. But, you know, there was a newspaper article written about me after I tried my first homicide case. And I really liked the reporter, and we kind of remained friends. And it was just talking about how I don't know, I guess you can just read it. I don't want to sound like an asshole, but he just thought like I had a nice style, and he was writing this little feature article about me. And when I sat down to meet with him, he asked me all sorts of questions about like, so is your hair naturally curly? And I was like, yeah, it is. And have you thought about straightening it? What, you know, why? I noticed that you wore really high heels in trial. Can you talk about that? And, you know, some of the jurors, they didn't like the way that you present physically. They thought your blouses were low cut.
Oh, my God.
And I remember, you know, being pretty self-conscious hearing that they all had all of these opinions. Because I was like, my God, you know, I was trying to murder. Like,
oh, God.
This is what we're talking about? Like, we're talking about my heels?
Have you ever thought about straightening it? Your blouses were too low cut. That's really offensive.
Well, what's particularly funny about that is I don't think I own even a single deep V-neck shirt that I wear to court. Like, I wear very conservative buttons up
top. You were just showing some chest skin, and that was too much.
Yeah, I know exactly. It's funny because, like I said, it's been, 8 years? And I know exactly what shirt they were talking about, which is the day I put my client on the stand, I wanted to wear lighter colors because I wanted to look softer. And usually my suits are like black or dark gray. And I had worn this like sort of camel colored suit with a pale pink blouse that was a scoop neck. And I had worn pearls, which I never wear. I'm not a pearls girl. I remember thinking, God, this is kind of uncharacteristically feminine, but I think that works because I want this direct to be soft. And I'm quite sure that that is the blouse they're talking about. And I've never worn it in a trial since. I think I threw it out years ago or donated it. But I'm sure that that was it. And I had like taken such care in trying to look softer than I normally do. And that was apparently the feedback. So,
oh my God, that's really unbelievable. That's so offensive that a woman would be scrutinized so closely and judged for that kind of thing. I mean, those comments would never ever be applied to a male attorney. I don't think. I mean, does Nick get or Nate? Do they get feedback about their clothes? And
no.
Okay.
Now, I'm sure every once in a while somebody, like, here's something that I will say for Nick Gansner. He is a snappy dresser.
Okay.
he really is. Like, Nick has really wonderful taste in men's suiting. And I'm sure occasionally somebody will notice that because he is typically better dressed than anybody else in the courthouse.
He's not showing up on the do not list.
No.
Of,
you know, so maybe somebody
fashionable
would notice that. But, oh, look, you can hear Alibi in the background.
I even love that your dog's name is Alibi.
Everywhere. sorry about that.
No, it's okay.
So, you know, maybe somebody would occasionally notice that, but it's not the same at all. But then, after I became aware that, like, you know, that's the sort of thing that you tell yourself is in your head, where you're like, okay, stop being a massive narcissist right now. Like, no one is actually paying attention to every little thing about how you look. And then when you find out, well, I don't know, maybe people are. That's a bummer.
Neuroses affirmed.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. I played with it for a little after and realized that and then I would have my staff call jurors afterwards to see if they had any impressions about my physical presentation. And as it turns out, I can report with confidence that there is no right answer for a female attorney.
Yeah.
That straight hair doesn't fix it. I personally, there are certain things that are true about the way that I present in trial every time, because I like to present in the way that makes me feel the most confident. And for me, I like my wild hair, so I typically wear it down during trial, which I've been told is unprofessional, but I do it anyway. And I'm just a hair under 5'10" in flat feet. And I like to wear four inches of heel because that makes me taller than almost every prosecutor.
Nice.
That I'm up against. And that gives me confidence, because one of the things that I really believe, I guess, as a feminist and as a woman, is that women need to not be apologetic about taking up space.
Yeah.
Like, I think we're allowed to use space the same way that men do. And part of that to me is that height differential. And so I like to claim that extra 4 inches of space. I also don't like to apologize for my femininity, so I don't own any pantsuits. Whenever I try cases, because I do think that it's possible to be both powerful and feminine, I choose to accent my femininity versus downplay it. Because again, that's what makes me the most comfortable and the most confident. And since no matter what I do, somebody's not going to like it, I'm just going to go with what works for me.
Oh my God. I love that. And those are so words to live by in general.
You know, because like, the hair doesn't fix it. The pantsuit doesn't fix it. Because for everyone that's bothered that you're in a skirt, there are two that are like, oh, she's in the pantsuit. I bet we know who she voted for. And, you know, so fuck it.
Fuck it.
That's what I've got. So fuck it.
Sort of on topic of how you're perceived, and sort of also kind of maybe as a way to bookend this interview, how has the response been to getting off that you found? The fan response.
Oh my God, people are amazing. So first of all, we get all sorts of like comments and emails from people who are like, you've really changed my perspective. I never would have thought about that, but listening to you, you know, that makes sense. And I talked about that. And that to me is just so fulfilling, to have people engaged in that dialogue and to at least consider a perspective that maybe isn't, you know, what they would initially be drawn to. And the other thing that I will say is particularly rewarding to me is that we did a couple different cases. We did a case of our own, the Andy Steele case and Aaron Hernandez, where we talked a lot about brain injuries. And a number of science people reached out to say, hey, you guys get the science. And that's so cool to us, because lawyers never get the science. And that was like, meant so much to me, to have people who, you know, have medical degrees and who are neurologists and neuropsychologists sending emails. Like, number one, you listen to my podcast, so that's cool, because you're pretty kick-ass. You know, like, you fix people's brains for a living. I can't do that. but number two, like, oh, God, it makes me feel so validated to realize that people can tell that we work hard at understanding the things that we talk about. You know, because I don't have any science background. I mean, I took practical botany in college.
That is awesome.
So that has really been rewarding. I mean, just the level of elevated debate that happens, like, in our Facebook group and with the emails and things we get, it just, like, restores my faith in humanity.
Oh, my God. I love that. And, you know, I completely understand that, too. Like, your podcast is amazing. The work you guys are doing is amazing. Is Nick everybody as happy as you are?
Yeah, we have a lot of fun with it. Although, I do think he's a little embarrassed that he's developed a little bit of a fan following that refer to him as a snack.
Oh my God, I love it so much.
I know, I do too. It's my favorite thing. And I'll tell you who loves it even more than I do are the paralegals at our office. They're all like members of the Facebook group that just lurk to see how Gansner is objectified. It's very fun. And I use the word objectified in the most loving way possible.
Yes. Oh my God, that is so funny. I'm sure that he is modest and humbled and embarrassed by it, but that is really delightful.
So, you know,
that makes me want to get on your Facebook group and post something inappropriate.
So, yeah. So it's really good. I think this is probably a good time for me to pimp out the podcast, which is called Getting Off. You can find it anywhere you listen to podcasts, and you can follow us on all the social media at gettingoffpod@gmail.com. You can email us. Our handle on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook is all gettingoffpod. So look for us.
And you also have a Patreon page, yes?
Yeah, and people give us money. What?
Yeah, but it's also it's just cool. Like, check out their Patreon page. Like, I love the way you guys have set it up, and it's really interesting.
Thanks. Yeah, we got so many requests for sort of the big cases, but then we get a lot of people who are like, we like that you don't only do the cases that everyone's already covered extensively. So what we're doing on Patreon is like a series of sort of hot takes or shorter episodes about cases like OJ. And we just did Stephen Avery for this month. We're going to do Adnan Syed. We'll do those there so that the people that are interested can give us a dollar and listen to our ramblings about that. But also so that we don't have to try and give complete descriptors like we do in some of our other cases when, you know, I mean, there are two really famous podcasts about Adnan. Mm-hmm. Serial, obviously, and then Undisclosed. So there's no way that in two or three episodes we're ever going to be able to cover things with that depth.
Right.
Yeah. You know, so it takes the pressure off us too.
That's so awesome. Yeah. No, I highly recommend the Patreon page and just checking out their episodes in general. Of course, I'm a little bit biased. I think the Casey Anthony's really good.
I'm glad.
is any case that you've covered more popular than any other?
So our highest episode listens has actually been Brock Turner.
Yeah.
But that was also the first case we did. So I think it's probably a result of people going back to the beginning.
Right. Yeah. You're probably getting new people all the time, just checking it out.
Yeah. And the NASA episodes, I think, brought in some more listeners since we stopped everything and sort of did those more or less in real time with that sentencing hearing just shortly thereafter.
Right.
So.
Awesome. Well, I wish you all the continued success, and I'd love to have you and Nick on again to talk to me more.
We should come on towards the end so we can talk about where we would have voted.
Okay. Well, I know how you guys will probably vote.
You know, I'll tell you, I don't know yet. I don't, as I sit here today at this jury break, I don't know that it's looking so great for old Keith.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm going to be interested to see how much emotion versus just pure legal jury instruction impact the decision making amongst the jurors.
Yeah, I'm curious to see too, and I'm obviously curious to hear the rest of the evidence because as I sit here, I couldn't do anything but vote not guilty right now because I haven't heard enough to.
Right. Yeah. We'll see what happens, but I would love to do that. I'd love to have you guys back on.
Well, excellent. We'll figure it out.
We will. Thank you so much, Jessa. And I look forward to finishing the rest of this Michael Peterson wrap up and your next installment of Getting Off when that drops.
Me too. And I look forward to learning more about what a douchebag Keith is.
Thank you guys for listening and for staying with me as we navigate this subject together. This is a controversial season, and it's going to stay controversial and probably get more controversial. And I really value the fact that you're listening. You're awesome, and for those who've reached out to me, thank you so much. I love you guys. In 2 days, we're learning more about statement analysis and the way Detective Suarez applied it to this investigation. Thanks, and have a great 2 days.